Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. We're entering the colder months, when germs circulate more readily, and cases of flu, COVID, and RSV usually spike. The worry this fall is that health officials from the Trump administration are pivoting away from long-standing norms and practices when it comes to vaccinations, for both children and adults, raising questions about who should be getting vaccinated right now, and will insurance cover the cost? We wanted to invite back to the show Politico reporter Lauren Gardner, who's been covering the latest news. Welcome back, Lauren.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
So let's catch up on some health developments at the federal level. You've been covering the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, which makes recommendations to the CDC. So in June, Senator Kennedy fired all 17 experts from this panel, and that included Columbus Public Health Commissioner Dr. Mashika Roberts. She was supposed to start her term in July. So the group now, it has less than half as many members and was handpicked by Kennedy, and some of them are considered vaccine skeptics. So let's start with the childhood vaccination schedule. So you've learned in your reporting that they're establishing a working group. Can you tell me about this working group? What's the mission of it? They're going to review the childhood vaccine schedule. Have they done that yet?
That's right. So work groups are very common within this advisory committee. They've existed for a long time. They focus on different issues. There's one on COVID-19, for example. And so we knew from what some members had said publicly that they were planning to undertake some kind of broader review of the childhood immunization schedule. And it's important to keep in mind that the schedule is, it's really like a living document. It's not static. There have been lots of additions made to it over the years, but also some tweaks along the way in terms of what is and isn't recommended for certain age groups and how strongly certain vaccines are recommended. So what this work group plans to do is they have a couple of kind of broad themes, topics that they want to look into in the coming months. So issues like the timing and order of different vaccines that are given to kids, something called concurrent administration. So for example, like when you go to the pharmacy and you get a flu and COVID vaccine at the same time, that's called a concurrent administration of vaccines. So oftentimes kids will go for their well visit and have to get multiple vaccines at a time. So they want to look at, for example, does the risk of febrile seizure increase or decrease when kids get multiple vaccines at the same time? They also want to look at the safety of ingredients that are included in several different vaccines, and that's expected to be kind of code for aluminum, which is a salt version of aluminum is used in several different vaccines to help kind of boost the immune response in the human body. Another issue that they want to look at is the safety and efficacy of different childhood vaccine schedules that are used in different countries, like peer countries like Europe and within Europe and Canada, Japan, et cetera. There have been a lot of discussions or kind of remarks along the way as they've been debating other vaccine issues, kind of mentioning that, well, other countries have a totally different schedule where, you know, not nearly as many vaccines are recommended for kids as there are in the U.S., which opens up its own can of worms. But that's among the issues that they're planning to look at.
Okay. This aluminum issue, from what I've read, there's worries that shots are different. Well, there's always talk about shots are different now than they were a long time ago. And there's different ingredients and there's always comments on social media. Read the ingredients. Is that what this aluminum thing is?
Kind of. It's one of those ingredients that's been seized upon by anti-vaccine activists. It harkens back to The issue of thimerosal, which is a mercury-based preservative that was often used in multi-dose vials. So it was, until very recently, pretty much only seen now in flu vaccine and only in ones where the provider is, you know, putting a syringe into a vial, drawing out a dose, and then they're able to use the same vial for, you know, X number of people that they have to vaccinate. There were concerns 25 years ago that thimerosal in particular was linked to the development of autism. That has been scientifically refuted. And since then, aluminum has also been put out there as an ingredient of concern. There's no data suggesting that aluminum causes autism or any other number of chronic conditions. And actually, by including a version of aluminum in vaccines, vaccine makers are able to not put as much as what they call antigen. So like the substance of the vaccine that leads to the body to produce the antibody response, they can use less of that by adding ingredients like aluminum salts that help, like I said, kind of bolster the body's immune response. So what it means is that it leads to vaccines that are safer, more effective, fewer side effects, way different than the vaccines that even you and I were getting back when we were kids.
This idea of studying what's being used in other countries, the safety of the vaccine schedules in other countries, I can see both sides of that. I can see where you're like, well, what are other countries doing? But who's the one who decides which country is doing it right and what's the better way?
Exactly. And it's important to look at this, you know, in the broader context. So if we're going to look at other countries like Denmark, France, Japan, other countries in Western Europe, they have very different health systems than the United States does, different geographies, different populations, different issues with respect to health and healthcare in those countries. You know, we've got a huge geographic expanse here in the US. We have, you know, lots of different pockets of the country, urban, rural, rich, poor, just many different considerations at play here. And the way that vaccines are or aren't mandated across these countries varies widely too. What they often point to is that countries like France, for example, I believe there are only two or three vaccines that are mandated for, I presume, school entry or what have you. Obviously, very different here, but that's determined on the state level here at the U.S. It's not determined by the CDC. States just often rely on CDC's guidance to make those types of decisions. But just because another country doesn't mandate vaccines in the same way that we do doesn't necessarily mean that one country is doing it wrong versus the other. It's just they have different considerations at play and different societal health concerns.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about vaccine news with Politico reporter Lauren Gardner. There's also been talk about the MMR shot, measles, mumps, and rubella, because there are measles cases all over the country, and it seems to be the one you don't hear about mumps and rubella cases, but you hear about measles cases. So there's talk about separating it. Are we talking about separating it because people just want maybe just the measles one, or are we talking about separating it because everyone wants to spread out vaccines? What's the deal there?
That's a great question. And I think it's both and. It would depend on who you talk to.
Yeah.
So going back to a few weeks ago when President Trump gave remarks at the White House about Tylenol and concerns that there may be a link between Tylenol use during pregnancy and autism, which is its own separate thing. He mentioned vaccines and the refuted link between vaccines and autism. And he has held this personal view for a very long time, for many years, that vaccine doses have somehow gotten bigger for kids, and that it's, you know, this vat of vaccine that is injected into them, and that they're getting too much at one time. It would be better to space them out. And it within that rhetoric has been this idea of let's split up the MMR vaccine. There are no individual antigen vaccines in the US anymore for measles, mumps, and rubella. There are no three single shots that someone can get. There used to be, but the MMR vaccine has been available since the early 70s. And I believe the last drug company that was making any sort of separate shot, Merck, they decided in 2009, like there's no business case anymore for making separate shots. So we're not going to do it. And there's plenty of data backing up that the MMR vaccine is safe and effective. It is reducing the number of jabs that a child is getting at a doctor's visit. The way the vaccine is made is it's providing protection against three pretty serious diseases. Like you said, you don't hear a lot about mumps and rubella, but rubella can be really, really dangerous, especially if a pregnant person contracts it, because that can lead to congenital rubella and lead to a whole host of complications for that child's lifetime. So there are lots of reasons why this has been, you know, condensed into one particular vaccine, and splitting it up is not, it's not as easy as it's perhaps been made to sound.
Well, we could talk about this for the whole hour, but I did want to move on to talk about COVID boosters a little bit, because the CDC earlier in October did accept an advisory panel's recommendation on COVID immunizations. Acting Health and Human Services Deputy Secretary Jim O'Neill, who is acting CDC director, he called it a return to informed consent. So what are they recommending right now when it comes to COVID booster shots?
So for COVID right now, the official federal approach is that the decision to vaccinate against COVID is a decision that's made between an individual and their healthcare provider. It's a concept known as shared clinical decision making. These concepts are really, I find them fascinating, because they're like, I understand the nuance as someone who is really steeped in vaccine policy, but really on its face, you don't go to the doctor and not talk about a vaccine, right? That is something that you talk about when you head to the pharmacy or you go into your doctor's office about, hey, you know, I'm thinking about this, getting this today, but I'm not sure, is this the right time? Let's talk about it. I think when you hear mentions of informed consent, there have been some criticisms, particularly among folks in the anti-vaccine movement, but also just generally speaking, that parents feel rushed when they take their kids in for vaccines, whether we're talking about respiratory season, COVID and flu, or the standard childhood vaccines we were just discussing. And they want there to be more of an environment where providers take the time to walk parents through their concerns about a given vaccine on a given day. That's something providers are generally supposed to do. But we also live in a world now where people need to keep appointments and get in and out of the office. So it's informed consent is there. It's just, it can look different depending on, you know, someone's individual circumstance. But getting back to COVID, it should be available for everyone. But what the federal government isn't doing is strongly recommending that it be given as a routine vaccination. So it's a slight messaging change from the federal side, but broadly speaking, COVID vaccines should be available to anyone 6 months and older in the US.
Okay. So if you're not, because they were saying over 65 with a previous condition, but now anyone can get one. Have you done any reporting on whether all insurance companies will cover the COVID booster, since there's been so much back and forth about this?
Yeah, that's a great question. So most insurance companies should be covering these. Where you run into questions are smaller health plans or state specific health plans. So basically not the big insurers. If you're on some kind of, you know, state government plan, maybe depending on where you live. But for the most part, most health plans have committed to covering all advisory, all vaccines recommended by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices through the end of 2026, regardless. And by that, I mean vaccines that have been recommended up until early September. So, you know, we weren't sure how the recommendation vote was going to go on COVID vaccines. It ended up being pretty standard. So insurers generally have committed to covering these, but what you might reference, going back to what you had said about, you know, people 65 and older, the discrepancy here is that the FDA label is much more specific about who should be prioritized for getting the vaccine mm-hmm. than the CDC recommendation. But from the folks that I've talked to who are lawyers, vaccine policy experts, CDC generally trumps the FDA label on a vaccine. So if CDC issues a broader recommendation, that should open the floodgates to insurers covering them, vaccines being broadly available by providers, and people just generally having access. But because this came much later than we have been accustomed to, that's where we ran into some issues where there was confusion at the state level. Some people who might have gone in early to get their flu shot, who usually they get their COVID shot at the same time, weren't able to. So that's where we're seeing some disconnect. And there's some concern that public health may have missed a slice of the population in terms of getting people vaccinated who wanted to be, but may not have the opportunity to return to a provider to get that COVID shot now.
We've been talking about vaccine news with Politico reporter Lauren Gardner. I want to thank you for your time.
Thanks so much, Amy.
And coming up, we're going to talk about measles cases here in Central Ohio and how public health officials are responding. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. As we enter the colder months when germs circulate more readily, cases of flu, COVID, and RSV typically spike. Public health officials are bracing for more of the same amid worries over conflicting guidance from the Trump administration and a rising vaccine hesitancy. In New Albany, confirmed measles cases from an unvaccinated family sent health officials into overdrive. And now there is a fifth measles case, unrelated to the others. Joining us now is Alexandria Jones, Assistant Health Commissioner at Franklin County Public Health, a registered nurse. She serves as the Director of Prevention and Wellness. She also serves on the Governing Council of the American Public Health Association and on the Executive Board of the Ohio Public Health Association. Welcome to All Sides, Alex.
Thank you so much, Amy.
So I wanted to start with the measles cases locally. I understand there's now a fifth case, but it's unrelated to the other four cases we heard about recently. So can you tell us about the fifth case of measles?
Yes, happy to. So that's correct. It is unrelated to the four cases that we have considered an outbreak. This case had recent travel as well, unvaccinated six-year-old. So that is something, just a different type of timing that we would not expect, but
so related to the fifth case, the newer one, do you have to follow where the six-year-old went to try to, like, alert people like you did with the other family?
We do. We do what's called contact tracing. So we are looking for individuals that may have been exposed for measles. It is a two-hour window of exposure. So that's what makes it a lot more infectious than some of our other communicable diseases, because it hangs in the air for 2 hours. So we do contact tracing with where that individual was during their infectious period.
Do you know that yet, or is this case of the six-year-old too new that you haven't figured out where to tell people to be alert?
Yes, and so we've already made those notifications. Fortunately for this situation, those were just healthcare in waiting rooms, urgent care exposure. So that's where. And so those individuals have already been notified and given the proper information on what they need to do to protect their health.
Okay. Okay. So with the case we had last week, with which was a family, there were four cases within one family, and they had gone to like a learning center and to a Target, right?
Exactly.
So what? Tell me about why you alert people related to those two locations.
Yeah. So for us, with looking at schools, as we know that those are microcosms of a community. So for those individuals, especially in the school that we were looking at, the early learning center, we had preschool, kindergartners, so that age where we are expecting them to get their second dose, individuals that could be more vulnerable, as we see a lot of times measles in more of the childhood population. So we have certain rules and stipulations that are set forth by the Ohio Department of Health through the director's journal that allows us to work with their schools to take additional actions as needed to really slow and stop the spread of measles in that school building. And then additionally, I know that there were a couple of public exposures related. So the reason why we do mass notification that way is because, as I mentioned, measles is hangs in the air for up to 2 hours. It's an airborne pathogen. So we don't know who came in and out of those locations. So that's really why we're wanting to notify the public that, you know, if you were in this area and you were unvaccinated, there could be a chance that you could have come into contact and become a risk for contracting measles.
Now, tell me about the word outbreak, because outbreak can sound like a loaded term, especially yes. in a post-COVID world, right? And so whenever I heard that it was a family, like there were four cases, but it was all in one family, mm-hmm. that made me feel like it was more like one case instead of four. And why is it an outbreak?
Yeah, that's a great question. So for us, the definition is an outbreak is three or more cases. So for this situation, even though it wasn't a family, we do are treating it as an outbreak, as we are at four cases in this particular circumstance. But we are, to your point, it's very fortunate that we are contained at this point, and we have not seen spread outside of that family. So the actions that ourselves at Franklin County and at Columbus Public Health, our colleagues that we have taken, have really slowed the spread and kept it contained to that family.
Now, would you argue with me that the word outbreak is loaded, or do you find that outbreak is an important word?
I think it can go either way. I think for us in our everyday, you know, outbreak is not loaded to us, but I can understand for the public, especially in a, like you were mentioning, a post-COVID world. I know that there's still a lot of stress and trauma that comes from that. So I can understand for that. For us, it's a simple way of how we manage our individuals that have been possibly exposed or who have come into contact with measles or any type of infectious disease.
Now, tell me about this quarantining thing. The learning center and kindergarten building served 500 students, so there was a potential for this widespread exposure of this highly contagious disease, mm-hmm. right? So if your child went to that early learning center and they were vaccinated, you would feel comfortable like reopening the center and sending them back. But you were saying that anyone that wasn't vaccinated, you wanted them to stay home.
Correct.
Did they have to stay home?
Yes. So there were situations. So for it gets a little bit complex between exclusion and quarantine, between what the school's taking action and then what the health department is taking action. So basically, if you have one dose of vaccination, you're 93% protected, which is great. However, there are the rules that I mentioned within the director's journal that do require for children to have the two doses. So we worked really closely with our school partners at New Albany Plain Local Schools to get those children that were eligible for that second dose vaccinated so that they didn't have to stay home and be excluded from school. Mm-hmm. So for us, for the quarantine piece, that has to do with individuals, both children and adults, that have no doses of vaccine. And then also thinking of adults who might not have any type of record of vaccination. So that's when we quarantine. That number is a lot smaller than the individuals that had to be excluded because of the one dose.
And we're enough days away. Do you feel like there won't be any more measles cases from this?
I'm crossing all my fingers and toes, it seems to be. So tomorrow, it will be the last day for quarantine. So we will be officially from that 21 days there. And then also later next week, will be for the exclusion for our children at the Early Learning Center. So we're literally hoping that we will be out of the woods here.
What do you tell the Early Learning Center that they have to tell these people they're not allowed to send their kids to daycare? Do you send them a letter in the mail? Like, what's the procedure there?
Yeah, so I can't say enough of great things about New Albany Plain Local Schools. They've been an amazing partner. So we did work with them to be able to provide some template letters and some documentation of basically, because it can be confusing. So what it is that they need to and how they can notify their parents to make sure that their children know that they need to be excluded for school because of this case of measles that's occurring. So yes, we did provide that. And then we also provided some quarantine orders as well.
Did you get any pushback? Because I feel like maybe some parents who have their children unvaccinated have their children not vaccinated for a reason. Mm-hmm. And so they're not afraid of the measles and they want to send their kid to the school.
Yeah. So I know for us on our end of things that we did receive at least one incidence of pushback. I'm sure that our school partners might have heard a little bit more as they have more of the day-to-day interactions, and they had more individuals who were excluded versus us who were those who had zero doses. So I would say that there is a little bit of pushback.
But on the other hand, you held a vaccine clinic, a measles vaccine clinic, this past weekend. How did it go? Did people attend? Did you vaccinate some people?
We did, yeah. So this was our second clinic that we held. We held a clinic earlier in the week on Monday, as I mentioned, to try to get those kiddos who were eligible for their second dose of vaccine so they could go back to school and not be excluded. So that was very successful. I think we vaccinated about 30. And then on Saturday, we saw about 37 individuals, both children and adults, coming in to get their vaccine. So we were very excited about that, and we continue to encourage people to get vaccinated, whether it's through us or through their provider, pharmacy, what have you there.
Now, the numbers I have are a few days old, but as of October 7th, the CDC had reported 1,563 confirmed measles cases in 42 states, including the ones here in Ohio. And that's the highest annual level in more than three decades. Tell me, are you worried about measles right now?
It's definitely a concern for us. You know, it's this is the highest level, as was mentioned, that we've seen in years here. So definitely a concern as we are looking at herd immunity. We want to maintain that status that measles has been eradicated, but we are at jeopardy for that because of the number of cases we're seeing. And with it being so easily transmitted, we see that when there are exposures, there are cases. So it is a pathogen, a disease that we are concerned about. And I think the big thing is, too, is that it's not, luckily, we haven't seen any deaths here in Ohio related to this. But, you know, it's not just a little rash. It can have immediate effects. It can have long-term effects. So definitely a concern for us.
And you mentioned that we're almost out of the quarantine period for that four cases. This one other case, you said that the child traveled internationally and then basically just went to the doctor. So do you feel pretty confident that maybe we won't see any more right now?
Yeah, it seems to be that the number of exposures were less than what we were seeing with the previous, with the outbreak that we are also responding to. So we are pretty confident that it will be, we're hoping that it will be a smaller scale and there won't be any cases as a result.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about measles cases in New Albany with Franklin County Public Health Assistant Commissioner Alexandria Jones. I want to switch gears a little bit now to flu shots and COVID shots.
Yeah.
So switching to the flu shot, how would you assess compliance with the flu shot this year? I don't know. It might be a little early, but who are you recommending get one, and are people getting flu shots from you guys?
yeah, absolutely. So right now the recommendation is all individuals 6 months and plus to go ahead and receive their annual flu shot. Right now we have had some pretty good interest in it. It is early in the season. I know people usually start thinking about COVID, flu, RSV, other types of respiratory illnesses when it starts to get a little colder. So we expect that number to pick up. But early indication seems that people are having some interest in it and are coming to our clinics to receive it.
And it's early to know whether this flu shot that they have concocted right now is going to work against the strain of the flu that we'll get, right? You won't know that until probably the dead of winter.
Yes, and that is something that we, in partnership with Columbus Public Health, we actually monitor our flu, we call it flu surveillance, on a weekly basis. So that is information that we put out that is public facing. So we monitor what's happening as it relates to hospitalizations, thinking over-the-counter medications, thermometer uptake. So those are things that we monitor throughout the respiratory season. So we will be able to tell throughout the winter months here how it is going.
So we were just talking with Politico reporter Lauren Gardner about COVID boosters right now. And there was a lot of confusion going around for a couple of weeks about who should get the booster and who should not and what was being recommended. And the confusion seems to be, I mean, the confusion is still there, I guess, but the decision is different. So from a Columbus or from a Franklin County public health perspective, who are you recommending gets a COVID booster this season?
Yeah, so we are recommending individuals 6 months and up. So it is a little bit stratified there. So for our 65 and older population, it is recommended that if they have any type of chronic diseases, any type of qualifying conditions, and similar also for our 6 months and up, thinking those who might have, thinking about an asthma, other types of chronic medical vulnerabilities that put them at risk. And I know, and listening to the previous segment about shared clinical decision making, that is something that is being recommended across all of those ages, to have that conversation with your healthcare provider, which, you know, can be us here at Franklin County Public Health. We do this all day, every day. So happy to talk to anybody about vaccines and about as they're considering what's best for them.
Okay. So I'm in my mid-40s. I have two healthy kids who, you know, are elementary school age. Do you recommend that we get the COVID booster?
Yeah, we're recommending that you come in and have a conversation about whether or not it makes sense for you to have that vaccine. So that would be something that we would love to have that conversation with you, and to make sure that we give you all the information so that you can make the best decision. So yes, we would definitely recommend you coming in so we can have that discussion.
Okay. So you're recommending having the discussion, but you're not, you don't want to actually tell people, yes, everyone can get the booster, or?
Well, I definitely do. I know that there is still a little bit of uncertainty as it relates to the actual, what the standing orders are going to look like and what those CDC actual orders are going to be. So from a public health professional, yes, I would say we want everybody to be vaccinated. It's a little bit tricky as we're still trying to navigate some of the what's being put out there as well. So
have you had any trouble getting the actual COVID booster, like the physical shot in-house? Do you have them?
We have. We have had issues. We actually just got them yesterday. So it's been a bit delayed for us. And that's something that we're actually working with our medical director on, creating those orders and what that looks like, so that we can make sure that we're giving everybody the opportunity to be vaccinated. So we definitely, as a public health entity, promote vaccines and want to make sure everybody's up to date and protecting them and their families. So my apologies if it sounded a little wishy-washy there, yeah. But it's definitely something we strongly recommend. We're just trying to follow the guidance as was recently released.
Okay. And so if you had any early birds trying to come to you for a flu shot and COVID shot at the same time, you didn't have the COVID shot in stock, so you were only able to give them the flu shot.
Correct. Yes. Yep.
But now, would you do both at once if someone came in?
We would. We would do co-administration, so a flu or COVID. We are still waiting for our childhood COVID shots, for our vaccine for children, for those who are qualifying under that program. But anybody who is privately insured, we are able to go ahead and vaccinate with COVID and flu.
Okay. So that was my final question, was insurance related. So there is a little bit of confusion, since things from the CDC and the FDA were going back and forth a little bit about whether insurance companies will cover it. Lauren Gardner told us that it seems like most insurance companies are covering all the shots for anyone who wants them. So do you have any issues with people being able to pay for the flu or COVID shots?
We do sometimes see people who have issues with that, but we are very fortunate that we have our Vaccines for Children program, which allows us to be able to bill our Medicaid providers here in the state of Ohio, and then also children who are underinsured or uninsured. And then we also have the 317 adult program. So that's for our uninsured adults as well. So we have vaccine that's available, and people are not turned away from the inability to pay if they qualify for those programs.
Okay. But if someone comes to you because you have a clinic or something and they have private insurance, you run it through that?
We do. We do. Mm-hmm. We accept most of the major private insurance. There are some that we don't, but we make sure that they get a referral to a provider who does, like a local pharmacy or another office.
Okay. And I heard anecdotally that pharmacies were able to get the COVID boosters sooner than, is that true? That pharmacies got them and like health departments didn't?
Yeah. You know, that's what it seems to be. And I'm not sure if it has to do with maybe volume ordering, with how much they are, with their quantity. So, but I know that our friends and the pharmacies have been providing, it seems like since August, late August, early September. So there's definitely access for COVID vaccine. So we would definitely encourage people to go get COVID and flu.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for your time. We've been getting an update on COVID and flu shots and also measles cases from Franklin County Public Health Assistant Commissioner Alexandria Jones. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Amy.
And coming up, we're going to talk with the past president of the Ohio chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. As we enter the colder months when germs circulate more readily, cases of flu, COVID, and RSV typically spike. Public health officials are bracing for more of the same amid worries of conflicting guidance from the Trump administration and a rising vaccine hesitancy. As public health officials here and across the U.S. are working to tamp down some measles outbreaks. Joining us now is Dr. Chris Peltier, past president of the Ohio chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. AAP is a leader in crafting the childhood vaccine schedules. Welcome back to All Sides, Dr. Peltier.
Thanks, Amy. It's a pleasure to be here.
So your organization takes part in Ohio's Champions for Vaccines. It's a group working to combat misinformation on vaccines. What reasons are you hearing right now from parents who are about why they're worried about vaccines and not getting their children vaccinated?
Yeah, that's a great question. And whenever I sort of think about sort of vaccine hesitancy, there's really, a couple of different sort of groups of sort of parents and patients, right? So there are those people that just for whatever reason, just do not believe in vaccines at all. They are convinced that they can cause harm or that we don't need them. And then there's probably the majority of the people that I see in my pediatric practice are parents that really just want to do what's best with their children and just have lots of questions and want to make sure that the vaccines that are being recommended are safe and just asking questions as to why they are necessary. You know, I think one of the biggest things we've seen over the last 5 years, you know, there's always been some history of vaccine hesitancy that really goes back now 25 years from a study that has since been disproven that the MMR vaccine was thought to be linked to autism, which has since been disproven. And that article was actually withdrawn from the literature. I think we really saw then a spike during COVID with the sort of increase in science mistrust and distrust. And now you couple that with the administration and Health and Human Services sort of, relooking at the way that they think about vaccines firing all of the previous advisors on the ACIP group, and then really, talking about things like when the president says, "I really think we need to separate out the MMR," when there is actually no evidence that would make any difference. And we know there's lots of evidence that shows that combined, the MMR actually is more effective than individual. So I think you put all of those things together, and I think that's how we've got to where we are now.
And then there's social media, which has contributed to misinformation and disinformation. And I constantly see posts where people say, do your research, and then they'll put a link, and then someone else will say, well, that's not a real news source. And and everyone's debating about where good information comes from. So where do you tell people to get good information from when people don't know whether to trust President Trump and what Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. are saying, or do they trust this article or that article? Where do people get the good information?
So I usually refer my patients to the American Academy of Pediatrics national website. They have the AAP has actually put out vaccine schedules decades before the ACIP was ever even created. So we actually predate sort of recommendations before all of that. And there are some really good pages on vaccine education, sort of distilling through the data that's out there, and I think is a safe place for families to get information. There's two other websites that I also like to recommend. One is called immunize.org, and the other one is the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia vaccine education site. Those are all sort of, sites that are vetted and have sort of the most up-to-date, reliable research and guidance for families.
Once a family decides they're not going to vaccinate their children, are they persuadable? Like, can you change their mind if you, as their doctor, wants them to get the childhood vaccines?
Again, I think that depends on, I talked about sort of the different camps of where a family is on that spectrum, because it really is a spectrum. So those families that I think that are so far off to the side where nothing you can say is going to convince them, most of the time, no. But the majority of families, I think it's just important to continue to have constant conversations, letting them know why this is important. And, unfortunately, sometimes just time and consequences. If a family's never gotten the flu vaccine before, and then all of a sudden a family member gets influenza and they realize how serious it is, or maybe they end up in the hospital. Often I've heard families tell me, "I'm never not going to get a flu vaccine now." And as we're starting to see more and more measles cases, and we're seeing some deaths from measles, that is very unfortunate. But we're hoping that people will realize that measles is serious. It's preventable by vaccinating, and we hope that that'll sort of educate some families like, yes, this really is important to do.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about childhood vaccines with Dr. Chris Peltier, past president of the Ohio chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. So earlier in the hour, we talked about the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices and how it is reviewing the childhood vaccine schedule. It's created a work group over that. Now, your organization, AAP, has been instrumental over the years in crafting the vaccine schedule. So, what is your take on the administration having this work group to reevaluate the schedule?
So I think you have to really understand what the ACIP did previously with having experts in pediatrics, in infectious disease, in epidemiology, in vaccine research that really would examine all of the data and go through all of the studies to make recommendations. So, I think people need to understand that vaccines go through a very, very rigorous research and testing cycle. And it sometimes takes 20 years for a vaccine to reach from its inception to actually being approved by the FDA. And the ACIP in previous years, doesn't automatically just rubber stamp vaccines, right? They make recommendations based on the best guidance. So many years ago, when the first vaccine to protect kids against rotavirus came out, we noticed that there was an increase in a condition called intussusception, which can be very serious in babies. It causes some obstruction of the baby's gut. And ACIP reacted very, very quickly to that. That's why we monitor for adverse events. Came to the conclusion that there was most likely a causal link and ended up actually pulling that vaccine, further research, developed new vaccine, which has proven to be safer. And I think that the biggest thing for people to understand, and as they talk about doing the research, and is the difference between causation as opposed to something actually being associated with it, right? It's very hard. For instance, people will quote that there is the vaccine adverse reporting system, and people will say that there are thousands of adverse events reported to the VAERS service every year. But what I think people need to understand is that is a non-filtered reporting system. So anybody can report anything to that system, right? So it could be a child received a vaccine, and then, 3 days later, they fell and hurt their ankle. That theoretically could be reported to VAERS. And it was previously the ACIP's job to sort of sort through all of those noise and really see, is there a true signal?
The review that the work group is going to do is going to look at the vaccine schedule in other countries and compare it to the United States. Is the United States supposed to be the authority of this, or I mean, it seems to me okay to look at what other countries are doing and compare. What are your thoughts on that?
So, I think when it comes to vaccine research, I really do feel like previously our scientists and the CDC really led the nation. I mean, I think we are the most advanced when it comes to pediatric prevention in the country. There are many countries that still, and now unfortunately, the United States is now one of them, having had 1,500 cases of measles this year. But previously, measles was essentially eradicated from this country, whereas many other countries, because of lack of resources, lack of access to medical care, don't those illnesses are actually very prevalent. So I think it's difficult to sort of look at other countries and make an extrapolation to here in the United States, especially when there's all of those safety studies already existed. You needed to do that to get the vaccine approved by the FDA.
There's a lot of people who ask why there's so many vaccines. You know, from birth to 18, kids can get 15 vaccines. But there weren't, someone will say, there weren't that many when I was a kid. What's your response to that?
So I'll go back even further. We actually had our chapter annual meeting this past weekend, and we had one of the pediatric infectious disease docs here in Ohio talk, and he went back to talking about sort of life expectancy for children in the turn of the century, in the early 1900s. And he said that it was not uncommon for one in five children to die from a infectious disease process by the age of five, right? So as we progress and as we technology develops and as we're able to protect kids against more and more vaccines, we are seeing less and less disease. We see, again, measles was a perfect example. Polio is a perfect example. Meningitis, right? We see because of continuing to produce more vaccines to protect kids against or against illnesses that either would end them up in the hospital with serious complications or unfortunately also mortality. Many of the trainees that and even physicians now have never seen a case of meningitis caused by Haemophilus influenza, have never seen sepsis caused by strep pneumoniae, which was very common when I was training back in the 90s. And that's sort of because of vaccines.
Pivoting a little bit to flu and COVID, are you recommending to all your patients, even healthy kids, not ones with compromised immune systems, but everyone get both a flu shot and a COVID booster?
I am. So, influenza, those recommendations have not changed. We recommend a flu vaccine for every child. COVID, the AAP has differed slightly. So the ACIP has recommended for children that children at high risk should receive a COVID vaccine. And there are many conditions, chronic diseases, asthma, diabetes, some other things. But then they also recommended, or they also stated that if a family wants to protect their child with COVID, after having a discussion with their pediatrician, that is allowable and should be okay. So yes, talk to all the parents. I recommend COVID vaccine to all of my families because we still want to protect really those kids that are high risk. And so really kids age 6 months to 23 months are at high risk of severe COVID. But also we still, there are many children that live in households with family members who are at high risk if they were to get COVID. Grandparents, family members that are going through chemotherapy or are immunosuppressed, and we still really want to protect the most vulnerable.
Do you just quickly, we only have 30 seconds, but do you one in each arm or do you spread them out?
So we do one in each arm, right? So I got my flu and COVID about a month ago and got one in each arm. So they've been studied together, and we know that giving vaccines, multiple vaccines, is safe and effective.
Okay. We have been talking about childhood vaccines with Dr. Chris Peltier, past president of the Ohio chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Thank you for your time today.
Thanks, Amy. Have a good day.
You too. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. If you missed any part of today's show, you should listen back at WOSU.org/allsides or subscribe to our podcast. Every episode is available to listen to at our free mobile app, the WOSU mobile app. And also be sure to like our show on Facebook, and you can find All Sides on Instagram at AllSidesWOSU. This is 89.7 NPR News.